Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode of Word in Your Ear is supported by Pact Coffee, who've just posted some of their energising and flavoursome wares to us, and a very happy experience it was all round. One of the ones I got sent had hints of chocolate malt milkshake, for God's sake.
Which I noticed that myself, actually.
Did you? Top notes. It made me feel achingly fashionable. Whole new experience. The whole thing is like a sort of psychedelic world that you can enter. 15 different flavours, like fruit and nut espresso. And one I think of a taste of bourbon cream. See, this to me, Dave, is just a
it's a whole new world.
You and I are older.
We grew up in the land of Nescafe and Maxwell House.
Bird's Instant Mellow. Digestive biscuit probably dissolved in it, you know. And horrible stuff that made you feel kind of nervy and edgy, didn't it? You know? And I can still remember the thrill of going to America for work a lot in the 80s and discovering the rocket fuel they served out there. What a key role it seemed to play in cultural life. And do you remember, you know, the various sitcoms that centred around the idea of coffee?
Absolutely. They're all coffee-centred, aren't they? Quite a number of them. Completely. Absolutely.
I mean, even Cheers. You know, there's a lovely line in Cheers I can still remember where somebody goes into the bar and Sam, Ted Danson, says, "Do you fancy a drink?" And the guy says, "What have you got?" And he says, "Coffee." And he says, "Anything stronger?" He says, "Yesterday's coffee," which is genuinely good of it. Frasier's Cafe Nervosa, I think, beats even French Central Perk as a sitcom's leading coffee-centric dramatic hub. And I love those incredibly funny and self-lampooning kind of rituals that Frasier and Niles act out when they're in there, and which send up their magnificent pretensions. In one episode, Niles, after looking aghast at the baked item that he's been served, says, "There are a number of things wrong in this muffin and that I don't care for. Away, wrinkly thing." Absolutely. And he orders a double cappuccino, half-calf, non-fat milk, with just enough foam to be aesthetically pleasing, but not so much that it leaves a moustache.
Absolutely.
And I love the fact that it matters so much to him. And it does. And if you fancy taking advantage of this Pact Coffee deal, and you would be foolish not to, go to pactcoffee.com, that's pactcoffee.com, where you can get 50% off your first and third orders, and create your flexible coffee subscription and enter your code, your ear, at the checkout, Y-O-U-R-E-A-R. And they put the name of the farmer on each packet, so you can trace the coffee all the way back to the place it was grown, if you feel so inclined. And as we said, there are 15 different flavours delivered directly to your letterbox. That address again with all the info at pactcoffee.com. Give it a whirl and you will never need to sleep again. And now back to the show.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So we're recording this on Record Store Day. And from what I gather, Mark, what you're supposed to do on Record Store, I was just reading something about people it was camping out all night outside a record shop in Cornwall, of all places.
I read that too. I thought I was so impressed that people still do that, actually.
Well, they never did that back in the day when there were loads of record shops, did they?
But I suppose it's the completest, isn't it? You know, that if you're collecting a particular band and they're producing a one-off, never-to-be-repeated special item, special record store day, you'd have to make sure you got a hold of a copy. You know, I mean, why else would you stay out all night in a sleeping bag? I really don't know.
It's really odd, isn't it? Because it's kind of, it's the invention of rarity, isn't it?
because
it's trying to make up for the fact that actually everything has never been more available than it is right now. There has never been a time when it's been so easy to find things as it is now. Therefore, we invent some rarity around the state. And I don't blame independent record stores. You know, they want to get behind it. It's a day where they're going to do really well. But I kind of can't get my head around it as a customer. I can't get my head around the idea that you queue up all night and then you're going to spend, what, £50 or £100 or something like that? Quite a significant amount of money on a load of records, largely because they're rare. You know, because my memory of the record shop is that, you know, it's a place where you just went in hundreds of times before you could afford to buy anything at all.
Hung around, debating for days whether or not you could afford 32 and 6 or whatever it was.
Absolutely.
Bank.
So when I think back to, you know, the record shops that have played a part in my life, that's what we'll talk about here.
Don't go on. Yeah, come on.
So the one that still looms largest in my history, my personal history, was actually the smallest place. It was a kiosk, effectively. I don't know if you ever had this down in Fleet, Hampshire, but up north, up north, where kind of you know, cinemas were a huge deal, and so cinemas had been built in the 30s and whatever, and quite a few of them had kiosks to the side of the cinema where you bought sweets to go into the cinema. Okay. And so this was a place in Wakefield where the kiosk was now a record shop called the Record Bar, you know, which is kind of a classic 60s name. Tiny little place, just about a room for two customers in the shop and two people behind the counter. And I remember the two people behind the counter because they were called Ken and Betty. Here I'm going back an awful long time. I can't remember anybody behind the counter of any other shop that I ever used to.
How old would Ken and Betty have been? Because their names suggest that they were not hip young groovers in kipper ties and flares.
Well, they were probably only in the late 20s, early 30s or something at the time. But to me, they seem to belong on the distant shore of, you know, where adulthood resided. They seem to me more like kind of Frank Sinatra people. Anyway, they were really nice people, and they very much cultivated their customers. And you used to go in the record bar, and it is no exaggeration to say, Mark, in 1966, 67, when you went to the record bar and you went to the new releases rack, and there wouldn't be many new releases, there might be 10, but you would read every word on the cover of those records, absolutely every
word. You were so ravenous for information and entertainment of a rock related nature.
I know, nothing can ever bring that back for me, you know, because that was, you know, the magic of records was intimately bound up with their scarcity or the fact that you couldn't afford them. You know, there were luxuries just up far above you, you know. So when I think, what would I most like to see in a record store day nowadays, what would get me excited? I don't know, it'd just be probably a copy of Five Live Yardbirds or something.
Yeah.
I used to just look at it and think, I wonder what it's like to listen to that record. I can't imagine what it's like to listen to that.
You would hold them and you would try and work out the sound of it, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would.
Because you had no other way of playing. It was not going to be on the radio, you know. No. Unless you'd actually say to them in the shop, could you put it on? which I do remember that being the thrilling thing about Virgin Records. My two record shops, I think very briefly, were Clark's Records in Fleet, New Hampshire.
Oh, well, was that like? What was Clark's
in Fleet? Oh, Clark's was in the mid-60s. I mean, it's a classic, an old electrical shop selling Hoovers and two-bar electric fires and all that kind of stuff. A little tiny, we've talked about this before, a little tiny record booth in the middle. And a guy looked like Peter Noon of Herman's Hermits in a really cool haircut and a little tiny button-down shirt with a tie. And he would get out his box of singles. And you could recognise the colour of the paper from the, you know, exactly which records they're going to be. The Beatles were always green because they were Parliament, etc. Yes. And I can remember the change culturally when I started going to places like Virgin Records, which I seem to remember going there in the spring of 1970 to get Van Morrison's Moondance. Do you remember Virgin in Oxford Street?
Oh, I do.
You went up a little flight of stairs.
It was above Shelley's Shoes.
Downtown or Shelley's Shoes, one of the two, wasn't it?
All right.
You went up a little flight of stairs and they had these listening booths. And they also had masks, I think, with headphones and stuff. But me and my friend Nick, who had no shoes on, I can remember, he had a pair of loons and it was barefoot. Come all the way from Notting Hill Gate, barefoot, to hear Van Morrison's Moondance. And we walked in, we had no intention and no capability of paying for it, actually. I can remember we heard it three times in this little booth. And I can remember the other records on at the time. It was On the Boards by Taste was there, Bridge Over Troubled Water, Black Sabbath, Deja Vu, Ginger Baker's Air Force. I can still picture that whole front counter, spring 1970. And that was so thrilling, just to sit there with these very cool people with their fabulous long hair, kind of giving you the thumbs up, and you'd wave at them when you want them to turn the record over. Your side too. That was great. I love that place.
Happy day.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
In all the various Word in Your Attic recordings we've done in the last couple of years, it's been really interesting how various people we've talked to had set up little kind of online businesses. Do you remember when we talked to Lloyd Cole? Lloyd Cole did this thing where if you wrote to Lloyd Cole and said, would you write out the lyrics to, you know, this particular song that I absolutely love, he would write it out and he would post it to you and you'd pay a reasonable amount of money. And Billy Bragg, do you remember Billy Bragg was getting all that stuff out of the attic during lockdown and finding old posters and things and old T-shirts and all sorts of memorabilia and just making them available, you know. And it struck me that this has now become an incredibly important part of the way people make a living, you know, because I got sent an email the other day about Nick Cave, who had a new record out, and somewhere in this email it mentioned Cave Things, which is his website. Have you seen Cave Things?
I've had a look, yes.
It's absolutely unbelievable. I mean, the concept is that the stuff is all designed by Nick Cave. Well, actually, I'm sure Nick Cave does have a hand in it, actually, which makes it particularly attractive. And he sells records and he sells books. He sells Warren Ellis egg cups, the Warren Ellis Pure Exploitation egg cup. He sells Warren Ellis combs, sells pencils, Lucky Charms. He sells complete tea sets. You're buying crockery. For 130 quid, you get a teapot and you get a cup and a saucer. And you get, there's jewellery, talismans, tiles. There's a whole thing of children's clothing with kind of little slogans. One of them says, don't let them tell you there are no monsters. Nick Cave, to quote from him, you know. You can get lyrics. You can get rejected artworks that he's drawn and weren't used in sleeves. You can get T-shirts with a. There's one that says he's a ghost, he's a god, he's a man, he's a guru, and a big picture of Nick Cave, 35 quid. Tote bags, wrapping papers, and one of my absolute favourite things is you can get a cashmere jumper range. One of them emblazoned with a quote from his mum, which says "Head high and fuck 'em all." In Kashmir, 450 quid.
I mean, that's mum.
God bless you, mum. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, so my mum used to say things like that.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
She didn't. And it's an odd business, isn't it, really? The stuff that you see in kind of catalogue form on people's websites, or you might see something might flutter out of an album cover or something, you know, offering a range of stuff. And is it not the case that nowadays selling a kind of holy relics, which these effectively
are. These are holy relics. Yeah.
There is like anything else, it's been transformed by the internet in the sense that in the past, if you wanted to sell T-shirts for your band or whatever, you had to manufacture them first. and you had to invest in them.
And you had to estimate how many you might sell. So you've got a
very difficult business. Difficult business, because you might sell a load, but if you've slightly underestimated, your profit is gone, you know, immediately those things. Whereas these things are, they're kind of standard items, presumably, but just adapted for different artists. And so you don't have to manufacture them at all until people actually order them, and then they're just automatically done.
Press the button and out comes
and they're
the
sent out. I know we've done this, you know, there's word in your ear merchandise. You know, we sell our own stuff. And the way this basically works is you put the design up, and it's available in, you know, those different colors and different qualities and so forth. And then people order the stuff, and then it's made and it's manufactured and it's sent out really, really quickly. It's unbelievable how fast these things can turn around. But the other thing which was struck me about Nick Cave is Nick Cave a very merchandisable concept? I never think of Nick Cave as being, you know, do you want to wear the Nick Cave uniform? If you're the kind of person that likes Nick Cave, surely you think of yourself as windswept and interesting and really individual. You don't particularly want to sign up in an army, do you? Maybe I completely got this wrong.
Oh, I don't know, because I think the thing is that the people who sell a lot of merchandise, the people who stand for something. Do you know what I mean? They have an attitude. You know, they represent something. They're symbolic of something. I mean, the people, you know, there must be a lot of punk rock T-shirts sold still. There's a lot of heavy metal T-shirts. They sort of stand for a lot of rap acts, you know. But Nick Cave, it says kind of soulful and deep, and it says literary, doesn't it? And it says kind of left field and hip and thoughtful and characterful. And, you know, I think a lot of people can identify with. I would want to identify. I would want to advertise themselves as that.
We're individuals. Here we all are wearing the same T-shirt.
Wearing the same T-shirt. I know, with Nick Cave on it. I know.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, well, yeah, but you may be right. And isn't it also the case that the bands who really sell, I mean, T-shirts particularly, isn't it the case that the bands who sell a lot of T-shirts are the bands who wore a lot of T-shirts?
Right. So who was that? You're talking about what?
Well, the Ramones are the kind of classic case. All heavy metal groups, you know, all heavy metal groups have somebody wearing a T-shirt.
Yeah, they do.
A Steely Dan T-shirt, even though it's, it's referred to in the lyrics of whatever it is, Showbiz Kids or whatever. Never seems to work in the same way. You know what I mean? There's certain bands who are T-shirt bands.
No, you're right, because by wearing them, you're going to look stoned probably as well. You're going to look more like a member of the band.
You sort of are. You're going to work, and that's the working uniform, isn't it? And you're adopting it at the same time. So, you know, is the world of music, and I'm just going to put this thought out there, and people can, you know, decide whether I'm right or I'm wrong, is the world divided into T-shirt bands and not T-shirt bands? And they're very, very different things. T-shirt band stands for the kind of, there's a kind of democracy about a T-shirt band. And then there's an elitist quality about a non-T-shirt band. Let me have 1,500 words on that subject on my desk by tomorrow morning.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
It struck me that this is the anniversary of a really extraordinary record. And I'm sure you remember this coming out, because on the 20th of April, 1982, Frank Zappa released A Ship Arriving Too Late to Save a Drowning Witch, one of which tracks was a track called Valley Girl by Moon Zappa, Moon Unit, his daughter. Do you remember that impact of that record? It was a hit fairly soon after. And I thought it was absolutely incredible, because at that stage, we had no idea who this social stereotype was.
No, I suppose not.
And she does this thing about, I just bought some bitchin' clothes. Oh, my God, your toenails are like so grody. It's so awesome. That's the first time I ever heard the word awesome. You know, it's like tubular, barf out, gag me with a spoon. And the chorus goes, tosses her head and flips her hair. She's got a whole lot of nothing going on in there. And it was just an extraordinary kind of social revelation, you know. And I think it's a bit like there are certain characters that were invented, you know, maybe Basil Fawlty, maybe Del Boy, Loads of Money. There's the PR character, invented by Jessica Hines in 2020. Do you remember that? 2012.
Yeah, remember that?
Siobhan Sharp. Maybe to some extent, Alan Partridge. There are certain people who just become absolutely, they manage to epitomize certain characters in the social structure. And that was one of them. And I thought it was really amazing. And that actually started a whole, the Sloan Ranger, like the Sloan Ranger being identified by Peter York in the 80s, you know. And suddenly that became part of the landscape. And I thought that was really interesting because the whole industry then, you know, would the film Clueless, Alicia Silverstone, you know, would that, I mean, that was all based on that notion, don't you think?
Well, it was it became a kind of stock rich type in movies and television, doesn't it, really? Yeah. I mean, you know, Jennifer Aniston's character in Friends is, it's not a valley girl because she's come from the other side of the country, but it's kind of similar in the sense nothing I would rather do than go shopping. You know what I mean? There's that part of
just
the
airheaded.
Yeah, absolutely, and enjoying being airheaded.
Yeah,
you know, reminds me of one of my favorite bits in Friends when Monica has a new friend, female friend.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And Jennifer Aniston, Rachel gets slightly jealous about this, and she said, "You didn't go shopping with her."
That's right.
He said, "Yes, I did." She said, "Wait, you didn't go to Bloomingdale's, did you?" She says, "Yes, I did, but it was only once. It meant nothing, and I was thinking of you all the time." She's just absolutely brilliant, right?
That's such a clever gag, isn't it?
It is fantastic. I know. But I tell you, the one legacy of the Valley Girl, you know, I mean, nobody talks about Grody and Tubular any longer, but the greatest legacy of the Valley Girl is the arrival of an adjective, which is now, you cannot move for this.
I know what you're going to say. Being it's awesome, used, isn't it?
It's awesome, which you can now, it's perfectly acceptable
awesome
to use to describe the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel or a new pizza topping. It's completely acceptable. Absolutely anything is awesome. So all the kind of gradations of quality in adjectives, and, you know, I suppose this is particularly the case when you think back to the days of print reviews of records or whatever, and you had to find a million different ways of saying good or terrible.
Intriguing.
And all of these have now been just completely supplanted by awesome or tragic or whatever. You know what I mean?
There's absolutely nothing in between, is there?
Nothing
so
in
awesome
between.
An epic. There's another one, isn't it? You know, and legend. Somebody's a legend. You know, they're a legend. You're a legend by simply buying somebody a half a bitter. You become a legend. You know, so.
Well, you're a legend. You now you're a legend. Really a legend. You're a legend if you're over 14, you're doing any of those things. Now, legend implies, my God, are you still alive?
But
kind of deliberate overstatement, said with no feeling whatsoever, goes back to the Valley Girl. You know what I mean?
It's the kind of
blankness of her affect, as we would say.
Yeah.
You know, combined with the ridiculous over-effusive nature of the words that she uses that makes the Valley Girl thing. And that, the invasion of awesome is the greatest and, you know, one of the saddest legacies of that whole movement, it strikes me.
It is. And it's also the idea that Emojo must play a part in this, that the people's vocabulary must be getting smaller, don't you think? They're just not coming up with the words, you know. I'm always very frustrated when people die and people post on Twitter, there are no words. And you think, oh, for God's sake, there are millions. Just sitting there or something. That's just because you just can't be, you're just sidestepping the issues. There are no words. Try! Just make an effort, please.
We're talking about the whole business of kind of coming up against younger people's way of looking at the world. I got sent this record, Mark. This is my record, okay? I'm holding up for the benefit of anybody who's not seen this. My compilation album, Deep 70s, which is coming out soon.
Yeah.
You've got it soon. And if you were looking at it, you'd see that on the front of it says, David Hepworth, Deep 70s, underrated cuts from a misunderstood decade, and a big graphic of a 12-inch vinyl, you know, LP. And it's rather exciting. Anyway, I put it on the side in the front room. It's just on the side on a shelf. And my youngest daughter had just come round this morning. And of course, A, she doesn't notice it at first. And then after about half an hour, she goes, "What's that?"
It's fairly self-explanatory, isn't it?
It's pretty self-explanatory.
Also, I would have thought fairly visible, but, you know, I may be
absolutely
wrong.
Absolutely.
It's fairly obvious that your father has compiled a vinyl album, in fact, a double album.
Yes. It's like, what further explanation require?
What's that?
Yeah,
I'm just not going to make the effort to think. I'm not going to make the effort to investigate. I know.
I hope she's not listening.
The Word Podcast. What's wrong with being sexy?
This word in your ear is also brought to you by NordVPN. And VPN stands for, what does it stand for, Mark?
Virtual Private Network.
That's absolutely correct, sir. Which is a way you can obviously keep your data safe on the internet whenever you're logging in either at home or abroad. It protects your identity and it encrypts your data, so that nobody can steal that identity. At the same time, it also enables you to access the internet via servers in more than 50 different countries. This means you can often sidestep region restrictions and stream movies and TV programs from around the world. And my latest discovery in my wanderings via NordVPN, Mark, comes from the wonderful world which is Swedish Netflix, which I heartily recommend to anybody because it appears to have absolutely everything I want to see. And I'm talking about a particular jewel I stumbled upon this week, which is Gonksko Beat. Are you familiar with
Gonksko? I'm familiar with this. This is a movie that came out in about, when I was 63, was it 63?
65, I think.
Oh, 65. And it's brilliant combination of the things that were fashionable at the time. One was the invention of gonks. The other was beat music. The third thing was sci-fi. I suppose the fourth thing was the kind of the upsurge in light entertainment comedy stars. So it's a mixture of all those. Let's throw all those together and it can't possibly fail to be commercial. And it did really well.
The plot revolves around a notional battle for domination of the earth between Beatland and Ballad Isle. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So it's actually beat music on one side or it's soupy ballads on the other side.
And it's got
Lulu and the Lovers. It's got the Nashville Teens. It's got the Graham Bond organization. So the first musician you see in it is a very confused looking Jack Bruce, the bass player with Graham Bond's organization.
Anyway, it's
absolutely bizarre. So on a more serious level, the film that I ended up watching most of, actually, yet again, God, I've seen it so many times, and I think it's probably the best film made about the Second World War. It's a bold claim, I know. This is the best film made about the Second World War, certainly by people who had been involved with the Second World War and therefore knew whereof they spoke. And that's, of course, The Cruel Sea Jack Hawkins.
Denham Elliott and Jack Hawkins. I mean, Denham Elliott was in the Air Force, wasn't he? Jack Hawkins, it was in the Welsh Fusiliers, I think, yeah.
But it's because the real enemy, as they say in the prologue, is the Cruel Sea. It's not the enemy, it's the Cruel Sea. And they play a convoy escort crew. in the North Atlantic. It's a brilliant film anyway.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So if you want to find all that kind of stuff, actually, well, another thing I found about touring the world via Netflix is that you have different territories in different countries, different ways of categorizing films in different territories. So the Swedes, for instance, have a section called Family Cozy Time. It's good to know.
That's great.
In France, obviously, they have critically acclaimed auteur cinema. That's
this
section.
Is so perfect as regards the nationalities.
But in the USA, I couldn't believe this when I came upon it. They have a section called violent films. Violent films. Like, say, I feel like some violence.
You know you want to. That's right. Yeah, that'll hit the spot. Hey, kids. So
if you want to find out about all this, you can take advantage of a deal where you can try NordVPN by going to nordvpn.com/yourear. Or just use the code YOURIA. You get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan and one additional month for free. And also a bonus gift. And it's risk-free because there's a money-back guarantee. 30 days. Full details, as ever, below in the show notes.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
And now we're joined by our Britpop correspondent, Alex Geld. And you were saying, what were you saying about the word awesome, Alex?
There is a popular beat number in the ether space that is dedicated to awesomosity. It's called Everything is Awesome. It's by Tegan and Sarah, and it was written for the Lego Movie, which is obviously a favourite picture flick of mine. And can I just read you a verse?
Yeah, go on.
Okay, here we go. It's beautiful. Blue skies, bouncy springs. We just named two awesome things. A Nobel Prize, a piece of string. You know what's awesome? Everything. Dogs with fleas, allergies, a book of Greek antiquities. Brand new pants, a very old vest. Awesome items are the best. Trees, flogs, clogs, they're awesome. Rocks, clocks and socks, they're awesome. Figs and jigs and twigs, that's awesome. Everything you see or think or say is awesome.
That's basically a rewriting of a few of my favourite things from Sound of Music, isn't it?
I suppose it is, the same concept.
It is. Brown paper patches tied up with strings, isn't it?
So anyway, Britpop. Is Britpop coming back, Alex? Well, something odd happened. It appears to be all around us. Go on.
It's back and how. It seems to be that most of the middling Britpop bands of days of yore are 10 times bigger than they were the first time around in some bizarre...
And they're all touring, aren't they?
They're all touring. It's
Echo Belly, Dodgy, Luke Haynes, Boo Radley's, Lush, Shed 7, Sleeper, all touring at the moment.
Shed 7? Shed 7 massive.
Yeah.
Reverend and the Makers. Remember Reverend and the Makers?
How could Shed 7 be massive?
When you say massive, what size venues are they playing?
I'm pretty sure they're playing arenas. You know, that size of venue, you know, sizable places. We're talking many thou of people. And of course, you know, it's just really, really bizarre. Reverend and the Makers are a really good case in point. You know, they were sort of, if anybody's not familiar with them, they were kind of, they came off the back end of the Arctic Monkeys. They were friends with them, and they sort of kind of shuffled in on their coattails. Fast forward to 2022, and they too are playing arenas, I do believe, and have a very, very sizable fan base.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It's bizarre. It's the same.
It's exactly what happened in, you know, all of those 60s bands, you know, the Neil Youngs and the Paul McCartneys and the, you know, Paul Simons and, you know.
Well, what's happened is that, you know, all those original fans are still there,
yeah,
plus their sons. So they've effectively doubled by their fan base by association. You know how many people the Strokes played to the other week in Argentina?
Go on.
And the Strokes are a band I still personally consider quite indie, even though they, you know, they had quite a lot of success. 94,000 people.
That's not indie.
That's not indie. Well,
that's a whole tour, right?
No, that was one gig.
One gig?
94,000 people. Liam Gallagher doing two nights at Nebworth, a feat which in 1997, whenever it was unparalleled by his former band Oasis. It was big news. Liam Gallagher plays two nights at Nebworth in 2022, and nobody really bats an eyelid. It's just expected.
So can we, and Mark and I were talking about it the other day, talking about how good Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets are, and they're currently on tour, absolutely all over the place. And we were saying, has Nick Mason won Pink Floyd?
You know, I think he has.
If it were a competition, is he the guy that's won? He probably has.
Oh, he has, sure.
Has Liam Gallagher won Oasis? Is that the case, Ali?
100%. I mean, there's so much expectation on Noel, I think, because he wrote all those songs. He'll always be, you know, that brief window in the 90s will always be the yardstick by which he's measured. Whereas Liam, I think Liam, in many people's eyes, has kind of blossomed in his own way over the years. You know, he was the troublesome oik who's somehow moulded himself into being this kind of man of the people. He does exactly what you'd want Liam to do. He offers nothing new whatsoever, but somehow he's all the more lovable for it. He just gives people
I understand that he's kind of arthritis problem, isn't he? Talking about he might have to have a hip replacement operation, which I thought was really, I was really, really felt for him, you know, because I thought it was particularly ironic because the people who usually have to have their, Steven Tyler had a knee replacement, you know. Billy Joel had a double hip replacement. In fact, Eddie Van Halen had a hip replacement. A lot of these people, because they actually throw themselves around on stage. The irony is, Liam Gallagher's stagecraft really involved him just sitting on the drum riser when he wasn't singing, drinking lager and smoking Benson and Hedges, and then standing in front of the microphone and doing the bare minimum of movement. So, but I feel sorry for the old geezer, don't you? God almighty.
I do, actually, but I think he's kind of brought it himself. If he'd drunk less lager and more milk, got his calcium, maybe, you know, maybe things would be different.
Oh, but, okay.
But he's also an avid runner as well. He started running, I think, and he started to run every day, and I think that's what's kind of done it. It is the irony of ironies, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So we got a bit of correspondence from Chuck Lonson, Patreon supporter, And he wants to know, because he's off to, I think, probably this very evening, see Little Feet in the United States there. So they're touring behind the 45th anniversary of their live album, Ways of Columbus. And they're playing the 17 songs that made up that album. And current lineup contains one founding member, Bill Payne. And also, it's got Sam Clayton on the congas and Kenny Grandney on the bass. And they've both been with the band since 1972. Fred Tackett has been with the band since 1987. And he wants to know, is he actually seeing Little Feet?
Does that constitute Little Feet?
Does that officially constitute Little Feet? You think it does?
Think it does. I mean, I think, well, you know, it's very hard to say. Either what matters to you most, that you're in the presence of genuine legends who were members of the group, original members, or that it sounds like, you could probably go and see a tribute band, I'm sure there are lots of them, would sound infinitely more like Little Feet doing Time Loves a Hero than these guys. But I mean, at least those are actual members of the group. Do you think it counts? But then again, we're back to the same old argument about the Stones. Is the Stones the Rolling Stones without Charlie Watts? I don't know. There's only two members of the original Stones. Are they?
The difficult thing with Little Feet is there's two Little Feets. There's three Little Feet, actually. There's the Little Feet led by Lowell George.
Yeah.
And then Lowell George kind of lost interest. And then you got the Little Feet led by Bill Payne. And then you got the Little Feet reassembled later on with Fred Tackett, who, to be fair, Fred Tackett was there in the early days.
Yeah.
He was a mate of Lowell George's from 1967 or something like this. And so he's not an arrivist, Fred Tackett. But you've taken away with the removal of Lowell George, obviously, many years ago by his, you know, he withdrew of his own accord and then he died. You took away a unique fingerprint, which no tribute group in the world can ever replace. You know, he was an utterly unique musician. And so
well, you're always going to struggle, aren't you, when the lead singer and the front man is no longer there.
Yeah,
that it's very, very hard to imagine that's the same group. So,
yeah,
but it's I thought I was pretty impressed that the Little Feet I saw in 1977 have still got three of those members in it. I mean, that's pretty good.
Perhaps the most extreme example is the Sugar Babes situation. Is the Sugar Babes right. The Sugar Babes when none of the Sugar Babes are still in the Sugar Babes?
There's not one of them.
So. No, so basically they cycle members so frequently that eventually none of the original band were in the band, and this incarnation of the Sugar Babes was comprised of completely different people, but it was still the Sugar Babes.
Well, they'd never been in the Sugar Babes at any point.
No, well, no, they were now, but at the beginning. So
right,
members kept dropping and being replaced. It's like that theory that your entire cell structure regenerates over the course of 7 years. So, you know, in 7 years' time, you technically are not the same person, but you are. It's kind of like that with a girl band, I suppose. But,
that's great.
My brain hurts.
The Word Podcast. Clearly, there is no plan.
Well, we're joined by another birthday guest, and how lovely to see him again. It's John Montagna. John, lovely to see you.
Good morning. Good
we
to
remember
see you
all. That room that you're in from last time, where you talked very, very entertainingly about Paul McCartney's bass lines.
That's right. That's right.
And you have a couple of questions, or a question for the agenda today.
Right, right. So this birthday of mine, I just turned 50.
Ooh,
big milestone.
I'm dreading being 50.
Everybody seems to be saying that to me. Oh, I'm so afraid to be 50. I was always afraid to not be 50. You know, speaking of McCartney, I saw a quote from his recently, where it was from the first Melvin Bragg interview. What was the show that he used to have?
South Bank Show, probably.
South Bank Show. Yeah, they got McCartney as the first South Bank guest, and I think they asked him about getting old. And at one point, he goes, "I'll be lucky to get old." So that was, you know, I thought that was kind of
my huge, favorite but. Gag on that front was Willie Nelson's 70th birthday. Willie Nelson looks fantastically older than he actually is, and somebody got up and said, "Willie, you don't look 70, but I remember a time when you did."
That's right. Like
20 years ago.
Let's do all those gags. All those gags. So Keith Richards, the wisest thing Keith Richards ever said was, "The older you get, the older you want to get." Which is really, really true.
It's really true.
Of course, UB Blake, UB Blake, the great ragtime piano player, is the quote attributed to him on his 100th birthday. Was, "If I'd known I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself."
Better care of myself.
Oh, that's great.
So anyway, you're 50. So, anyway, yeah, that made you think of what?
Well, it was actually during my 40s that it occurred to me that a lot of the music that I love the most and has inspired me the most was made by people in their 40s. When it started to dawn on me as a musician, you know, crossing 40, I was like, no, wait a second. You know, I was like, I'm not young anymore. I was like, well, wait a second. So I brought a few samples.
All right.
I'm probably the only person that prefers this to All Things Must Pass.
Wow. So you're holding up a copy of George Harrison.
Cloud Nine. That's a good record.
Nine, is that record?
Oh, it's a really good record.
Yes.
Has he got When We Was Fab on it?
It's got When We Was Fab, Got My Mind Set on You, Fish on the Sand.
That's right.
Just like track for track, there is not one bad song on
this.
Yeah,
it's a great record.
And I just feel like he's a guy with nothing to prove on here.
Right.
He's like, I'm going to have some fun with my mates in the studio, and you're not going to tell me what to do. And I just, I love it. And then again, give my regards to Broad Street. I'm sorry for my ring light reflecting on the LP cover. And Tug of War, my favorite McCartney album.
Really?
Yeah, Tug of War's a great record.
Yeah. You guys used a great phrase the other day when you become such a fan of someone that you own everything they've ever done. You're no longer a fan. You're a supporter.
Yeah.
So I'm a McCartney supporter. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I'm definitely like that with McCartney. Every fireman, all the stuff. And Tug of War, by far my favorite one. Sinatra at the Sands. He was 50.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was it? Yeah, really.
He announces it on the in the show.
There's I love the intro to that record, where it starts with the cymbals, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
The Sands. Welcome to the Sands. We're proud to present Crab Basie and his wonderful band.
Yeah,
and so a man in his music, Frank Sinatra, and the audience, and they're watching what is effectively proven to be the greatest show in history.
Correct.
And the audience just go,
right?
You know what I mean? Exactly. There's not a whoop to be heard at all in that intro.
Right.
Anyway, sorry. And, carry on.
No, but that was. There's a long. It's on the. It's called the Tea Break. It was like a monologue that is like 10 minutes of him just talking, and he talks about how he just turned 50. There's a rumor going around that I turned 50, and I want to tell you it's a dirty communist lie. It's great. So I thought, okay, so he's 50. Miles Davis, the second great quintet, he was in his 40s.
Right.
So all of the Sting, Ten Summoner's Tales, all the stuff that I really, really love was made by guys who were a little bit older and women who were in their 40s. And I was wondering if you guys had any sort of opinions of your own about this, about artists who, when they cross a certain age and the characteristics of an artist who is aging gracefully. And what that looks
like. Well, I've got three people I'd mention. They might be really obvious to you. Leonard Cohen, Lucinda Williams, and Nick Lowe. Because I think they were all working in a mindset that was slightly older than they were at the time. And they kind of grew into those people. Nick Lowe is much more convincing, I think, as a kind of disillusioned middle-aged man than he was as a kind of thrusting youth. You know?
That was going to be my question. What did you mean when you say, like, an older mindset?
Well, Nick Lowe's songs now are mostly about slightly remorseful and slightly regretful.
Yes,
they're not about tackling, you know, they're not about, hey, everybody, I'm this age and I'm really dealing with it.
Right.
It's just the reverse. Lately, I've let myself slide. You know, it's the idea that he's looking back to the person he once was and he's a kind of crumbling, dilapidated version of that.
Right.
And I think Lucinda Williams is quite the same, actually. Yeah. You know, that she's sort of, you know, she's now kind of just dealing with the complexities of middle age, not really being able to deal with it, but just expressing it, you know.
I think Nick Lowe does it fantastically well.
Yeah, he does.
And was there a song, There's Hope for Us All?
Yeah.
When even I, a feckless man who's thrown away every chance or something like that, can find someone to break his fall, there's hope for us all. And it's the idea that Nick Lowe writes about kind of having achieved some level of domestic contentment after a lifetime of kind of throwing it away.
Yes.
And I don't know anybody else who's done that. You know, and I think you're right, Leonard Cohen and Lucindy Williams and these kind of people. And people like James Taylor,
Newman,
really, really well. But I think Nick Lowe, it does it better than anybody. It made a series of wonderful records, one of which was actually called At My Age, isn't it?
At My Age,
you know what I mean?
And those images, that untouched takeaway I brought home the other day, might have a lot to say.
Yes.
Everything just sitting there looking at himself and thinking, look at me. This is
so if you haven't investigated those yet, that would be my tip to you.
Also, I mean, I'm a huge fan anyway, and a hugely underrated bass player too.
Oh, yeah. Bass player.
I mean, underrated in every respect.
Yeah, he is.
So what are you doing for your birthday, or have you had it?
My birthday was on Monday, and we were actually in Arizona. We have a house out there that we're sort of having to clear out and prepare to sell. So we just, my son and I flew back yesterday. So I'm just kind of waking up, actually. It's 8 o'clock in the morning out here in New York. So,
Well, have a good day.
You're listening to the Word Podcast, where the time is whenever you want it to be.
And we're back. Alex, what have we got coming up we should tell people about?
Well, we just happen to have the event of the year coming up on Saturday, June the 18th.
Absolutely.
Which happens to be Paul Thumbsaloff McCartney's 80th birthday. And
that's incredible. 80th.
We felt, I know. We felt it was the right thing to do as his good pal to throw him a party. An unofficial party. So that's what we're doing. Opera Holland Park. We've booked the weather, which is going to be fantastically sunny. And anybody who was there last year, you'll of course know what a wonderful day it was. And anybody who wasn't, we highly recommend you buy a ticket.
We should say it's a gorgeous tented venue, and it's outside with there's a canvas stretched above you. In the unlikely event that it would rain. And it's just out in this gorgeous park, isn't it?
Licensed bars,
booksellers.
All the best people are there. And we're lining up a selection of people who are going to talk about Paul McCartney and what he means to them and their particular take on Paul McCartney. So it's a unique opportunity to celebrate a once-in-a-lifetime event. Paul McCartney's 80th birthday. So that's our Word in Your Park, which is on June the 18th. Is that right?
Yeah. June the 18th, that's correct. And you can get tickets at wiyelondon.com, or there'll be a link in the show notes of this very show as well. So,
and we should mention some of the Word in Your Attic things we've done recently. There have been some really good ones, haven't there? John Ronson, we did Edgar Wright, was a while ago. Actually, Stephen Wilson, very recently. Alexis Petridis, who was fantastic. Viv Groskop, Stuart Lee, Jenny Colgan. There was a lovely one, actually, I don't know if we put it up yet, but it's coming up in the next couple of days, with a guy called Nick Durden.
Yes.
Who's written this wonderful book about the afterlife of fame, isn't it?
It's called Exit Stage Left.
That's right.
Nick Durden on the curious afterlife of pop stars. And which is, you know, pretty much explains what it's about, actually. And it's funny, I was just looking earlier on the interview with Alex Kapranos of Franz Ferdinand. It's particularly poignant because he seems to me to be eaten up by the fact that his band aren't still quite as big a deal as they were in 2004. You know, he's quite confessional about the fact that it's the kind of decline in public attention that really eats away at people.
Yeah, I thought it was very honest of him to say all that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, a lot of people must feel the same by just pretending that they don't, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That book is full of all of it, isn't it? You know, Viv Albertine talking about the end of the slits being like the end of a marriage, you know. And Eddie Tenpole Tudor talks about how he's desperately trying to keep the flame alive because it gives him all the love and attention he never got for his mother. So interesting.
And it's funny, I think it's an instructive contrast between that and another guest that we had recently, who's David Scott of the Pearl Fishers, one of my favourite musicians. And David has a life where he's kind of, he does a lot of broadcasting stuff, he does lecturing and so forth, and does the Pearl Fishers. It is kind of a passion project. He's found a way to do it. But it strikes me he's not bitter at all, is
not
he, about the fact that they've never kind of been a chart busting outfit. And he's less bitter because he's never had that glimmer, really.
I think that's really interesting. You know, it's like Elvis Costello's relationship with Oliver Zahme. You know, that it's a blessing and a curse, isn't it? It's a blessing that got him all that attention. It's a curse that people want to hear it, which you can't really play it anymore now for obvious reasons, lyrically. But you're stuck with that, and you're constantly living up to that kind of level of success. And if you just tinker along as David Scott is and make a living, you're perfectly happy.
He's absolutely grateful to have the opportunity.
Grateful to
have
the audience at all.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So those two coming up soon and loads more behind them. Please stay tuned.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.